Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. At the moment, that war is actively underway, it would appear, in a variety of places in the continent of Africa. We don't address it as often as we should, I think, but there's no getting around it today. It is in the front lines of some very important, well, you might even call them tectonic shifts. I'm very pleased to say to have with us for the first time Joshua Mezervy. He is these days a senior policy analyst in Africa and Middle East matters at the Heritage Foundation. He has served as a Peace Corps volunteer, has worked for the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Africa, also has worked in the refugee resettlement business there, as well as worked for the U.S. Army's Special Operations Command and the Atlantic Council's Africa Center, a distinguished pedigree indeed. He is most welcome to join us to talk about some of these developments in Africa that are of concern to, I think, all of us at the moment. Welcome, Josh. It's so good to have you. Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks so much for having me, Frank. Happy to be here.
Let's talk first and foremost about this business in Zimbabwe, where it seems like the president for life, Robert Mugabe, has finally run out his string. Is that right? And what are the implications of the denouement of this crisis?
Yeah, it certainly appears, as you say, that Mugabe's time is blessedly and finally up. This is unequivocally one of the worst rulers to blight the earth, I would say. He's been in power for 37 years, ran his country, Zimbabwe, which was once a prosperous and peaceful country, really into the ground. Because he is such a survivor, I don't want to say with no reservations that he is actually gone. It certainly appears that way, but we'll have to wait until the fat lady sings, as they say. So, the military has moved into Harare, which is the capital of Zimbabwe, and has placed Robert Mugabe, his wife, and several other leading politicians under house arrest. The ruling party, which is ZANU-PF, has essentially distanced themselves from Robert Mugabe, but he is refusing to go gracefully, which is no surprise, of course.
What would you say is likely to follow if he does, in fact, move on voluntarily or involuntarily?
Right. Well, I think that, unfortunately, what we're going to see here is the ruling party that I mentioned earlier, ZANU-PF, maintaining its grip on the country. I say unfortunately because, yes, of course, Mugabe was the despot that had ultimate responsibility for his country's destruction. But the ZANU-PF system, the party, is very much culpable as well. We shouldn't be fooled into thinking that someone from ZANU who takes over the reins from Mugabe will be some sort of democratic savior of this country. It appears that his vice president, who was ousted earlier this month, will be that man to head the next government. His name is Emmerson Mnangagwa. This man was the architect of one of the worst massacres in Zimbabwean history back in the 80s, where around 20,000 people, probably more, were murdered and starved. So this is the sort of man who is likely to succeed Mugabe. He might be in a coalition government with an opposition figure that, again, the details are hazy. So I don't want to be too pessimistic because there is reason to be joyful here that Mugabe is gone, but we also need to be very cautious and hope for and push for, you know, the opposition being strongly represented and then moving towards free and fair elections.
Joshua Mezervy, is there any possibility, you mentioned that the army had stepped in to seize Mugabe, is there any chance that he will be succeeded by a military that is more benign than this party of his, or are they fully implicated in what has been done?
Yeah, it's a good question. The military, unfortunately, is fully implicated in what has been done to this country. The military traditionally was a strong source of support for Robert Mugabe. They flipped on him. Tensions have been building for more than a year now. And eventually they flipped on him because he appeared to be trying to position his wife, named Grace Mugabe, to succeed him. The military doesn't like Grace. She doesn't have any liberation struggle credentials. She doesn't have a military constituency of support. They much preferred this man I spoke about earlier, Mnangagwa, who does have strong support within the military. So, as I say, the military flipped on Mugabe when they felt that their preferred candidate for succession was losing out. The military, we need to be very cautious about them as well.
Yeah, there's not much hope there. This is just a heartbreaking situation because, as you say, this is another of these cases. Venezuela comes to mind, too, where an extraordinarily rich and prosperous and coming nation was truly destroyed. Let me turn to another country that's been having its own travails, and there's, again, some news as to what's happening there at the moment, a little farther north, Kenya. What is happening there at the moment in terms both of the politics of the place and the possibility of new bloodletting?
Right. So this is concerning as well, unfortunately. Kenya, a strong American ally, an important economy in East Africa, but they've been locked in an election dispute, which for about a decade now, elections have been a bit of a bugaboo for this country. In 2007, they had terrible post-election violence. So this round, the first round of voting was actually, the results were actually overturned by the Supreme Court. The first round returned the incumbent president, Uhuru Kenyatta, to power. The opposition challenged it in court, and the court sided with the opposition, saying that illegalities and irregularities had occurred that nullified the election result. It's a bit of a strange decision because they nullified, as I say, the presidential results, but not the governorships and the parliamentary results and things of that nature. So some legal questions for scholars who are more versed in legal matters. But there was a second round of voting as prescribed by the Supreme Court, which the opposition boycotted, saying it couldn't be free and fair. The Independent Electoral Board that governed the elections had a number of problems. And eventually the incumbent won the second round again, this time with 90-something percent of the votes, just because the opposition had boycotted, as I said. So now the opposition went back to the Supreme Court asking them to overturn the results of the second round. The Supreme Court just said, no, the second round was legitimate. So now we're a bit on tenterhooks here, waiting to see how the opposition will react, if there's going to be violence around this, or if the opposition will concede defeat finally.
Is there any involvement in all of this from the Al-Shabaab folks? Are they complicating the security situation in a way that is contributing to some of this turmoil? Or is that just another problem in the neighborhood and to some extent even on Kenyan soil?
Yeah, it's another problem in the neighborhood. Al-Shabaab is always a subtext to security concerns, just because it's a committed and vicious terrorist organization that strikes Kenya somewhat frequently, usually more towards the border region that Kenya shares with Somalia, which is where Al-Shabaab's home base is. But around these elections, there were, of course, some concerns that Al-Shabaab would try to attack a polling place or something like that, some easy target of opportunity where they could kill as many people as possible. We didn't see that, fortunately. So most of the concerns right now are around political violence within Kenya and the various factions taking up machetes and arms and taking it to the streets, which would be really devastating.
Especially from a U.S. point of view for the fight against folks like Al-Shabaab. Joshua Messervig, I was hoping we would talk a little bit about South Sudan as well, but we were hard out of time. I hope you'll join us again soon to do that. I appreciate tremendously your perspectives on Zimbabwe and Kenya, and look forward to finding out more about what's going on in the continent that you specialized in, and do so much with at the Heritage Foundation. Come back to us again very soon if you would. Next up, we will be speaking with Robert Spencer about developments on freedom of speech and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are joined by Robert Spencer, one of the men I admire most in the, well, I call it the counter-jihad battle space. He is, of course, the director of an extraordinary online resource, Jihad Watch, which is a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. He has just returned from the Freedom Center's latest and extraordinarily successful, by all accounts, Restoration Weekend in Palm Beach, Florida. And it's always good to catch up with him, especially when there are some very momentous developments taking place. Robert, I want to congratulate you on the publication of your new book, Confessions of an Islamophobe. I'm not particularly keen on that top title myself, but I know the point you're trying to make is you are no more an Islamophobe than I am, or indeed any of us are, but we're truth tellers and we're nonetheless pilloried for that with that term. Talk a little bit about the book and the key point that you're trying to make with its title and content.
Absolutely. Thank you, Frank. The idea of Confessions of an Islamophobe is to show what happens when an individual starts to call attention to the motivating ideology behind the jihad terror threat. You get abused, defamed, smeared, hung with the spurious propaganda term of an Islamophobe. It's really the idea of Islamophobia is a conflation of legitimate analysis of the motives and goals of jihadis with vigilante attacks on innocent Muslims. No, the two don't go together. And of course, nobody approves of those vigilante attacks, but they're trying to crowd out the legitimate analysis by calling the two by the same title, Islamophobia. And so in the book, I show what is at risk here for women, for gays, for secular liberals, and for other groups if they continue to stigmatize any criticism of jihad violence and Sharia oppression as Islamophobia.
Yeah, it's such an important point, Robert. And I think the challenge is that, of course, we're finding this coming not simply from the usual suspects. Well, I think of them as Sharia supremacists, a term that Andy McCarthy is helping to popularize. It's part and parcel of their agenda, of course, to silence us, to keep us from being heard, as we warn, as you say, about the jihad movement writ large, which is, of course, to include the stealthy kind of the civilization jihad form, the Muslim Brotherhood practices in countries like ours. But it's also being enabled by the left, isn't it? And you recently had a very tough go of it out at Stanford University, where you confronted this sort of red-green axis operation at work. Tell us a little bit about what happened there.
Yeah, I spoke for about 5 or 6 minutes. And then 80 to 90% of the crowd stood up and walked out.
This was a full house, by the way, as I understand it. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. I started out with a packed house, and there was also a large group of people trying to get in, so then there wasn't room. And so the people who actually had wanted to attend then tried to get in after they left, and the Stanford administrators present would not allow them to come in. They also wouldn't allow streaming of the event, clearly because they knew this was in the offing and they didn't want Stanford to look bad in a live video.
Well, it should look bad, needless to say. And the point of these demonstrators was, again, as I understand it, Robert, to try to silence you or at least minimize the audience that could hear you, which is effectively the same thing, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And it was Muslim groups and leftist students and, of course, the leftist administration of Stanford, the red-green axis here again, colluding to make sure that as few people as possible heard what I was saying.
Which brings me to a whole nother subject, and you really are so admirable in so many different ways, Robert Spencer. Your daily accounts of what's happening at Jihad Watch, your myriad books, I've lost track of how many there are, but they are a superb collection, needless to say, and notably the one that's just come off, I know will be among the most important confessions of an Islamophobe. But I'm very concerned, as I think you are, about how this effort to silence folks like thee and me and many, many others is now metastasizing beyond organizations like the Southern Poverty Law Center, the SPLC, and the Anti-Defamation League to, among others, the internet giants. Talk, if you would, Robert, about the latest out of Twitter and how it might have very far-reaching effects on our exercise of a God-given constitutional freedom of expression.
Twitter has essentially announced that it's going to become a surveillance organization enforcing the leftist agenda. Using the Southern Poverty Law Center's spurious hate groups listing, it says that it's in December going to start to monitor the behavior of its account users actually when they're not on Twitter and when they're offline, and close their accounts accordingly. So I think that what we're going to see if they follow through on this in December is a massive purge of voices that are not on the left from Twitter. And of course, that'll be the end of Twitter as any kind of effective voice. One of the accounts they will no doubt have to close if they follow through on these guidelines is that of the President of the United States. And that just underscores the absurdity of all this.
Yeah, well, the absurdity, but also the danger associated with it. We are very likely to see these folks who are essentially unaccountable. Let's face it, they amount to utilities, really, in the sense that they're basically monopolies. There are no checks and balances, as things stand now, on what they do or how they do it. And Robert, one of the things you've confronted is the sort of extension of European hate speech codes through these entities like Twitter, like Google, like Facebook. How has that in practice affected Jihad Watch?
What Twitter and Facebook did is shadow ban Jihad Watch, which means it's still there, it's still visible, but it's very hard for people, if they see an article there, to share it on Facebook or Twitter. And in February, after for years, Facebook would have 20,000 people a day coming to Jihad Watch from Facebook when they saw news items from Jihad Watch on Facebook. That suddenly dropped 90% to about 2,000 a day, and Facebook dropped from 2,000 a day to 200, 90%. From both dropped on the same day. It was clearly a planned effort, and it's never recovered. They are choking off the readership to Jihad Watch and to other sites that tell the truth about these issues. In accord with the European Hate Speech Code, the Facebook Vice President, Joel Kaplan's assurance to the Pakistani government, he was in Islamabad last summer, and he promised the Pakistani government that material that was considered to be blasphemous according to Sharia would be removed from Facebook.
Well, it makes all the more important the work you're doing, Robert Spencer, and we're delighted to call attention to it. Robert, let me ask you quickly and lastly, H.R. McMaster, the president's national security advisor, has been a controversial figure for some time. I have reason to believe that that controversy may intensify here in the past, in the next few days. Would you just give us a sense of how he has comported himself, specifically in this jihad space, in that job as the president's top foreign and defense policy advisor?
Well, you remember that President Trump ran while rebuking Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton for refusing to name the enemy. You can't defeat an enemy you don't understand, much less one you refuse to understand. And that's what the Obama administration was committed to, pretending that Islamic terrorism had nothing to do with Islam. And so Trump seems to be promising that he was going to turn that around. And yet McMaster has been a vocal and consistent and strenuous opponent of such efforts and a real spokesman for the Obama agenda in terms of continuing to pretend that the jihad threat is not really what it is and doesn't come from what it comes from, such that he has hamstrung our ability to implement more realistic measures that would deal with this situation a little bit more effectively.
It is Obama's third term. He's got to go. Unfortunately, so do we. Robert Spencer, thank you so much for your time today and for all the great work that you do at jihadwatch.org and for the larger cause as well. Keep it up, my friend, despite adversity. And congratulations again on the publication of your new book, Confessions of an Islamophobe. Folks, check it out. Next up, Gordon Chang joins us. We'll talk about the latest.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We're joined, as we have the privilege of being each week, by Gordon Chang, our duty expert and that of, well, it seems most of the free worlds, on Asia. Gordon is, of course, a columnist for the Daily Beast. You can find him frequently on Fox News and other media outlets. We're always delighted that he's with us here for Secure Freedom Radio. He's also the author of two evergreen books, I think it's fair to say, one on the coming collapse of China, the other on nuclear showdown, North Korea takes on the world. Gordon, I want to talk to you about the nexus between those two plot lines, if I can. Welcome back. It's good to have you as always.
Thank you so much, Frank.
So the president, of course, wrapped up his trip to Asia last week, and one of the issues that's on everybody's mind and was apparently a subject of considerable conversation, at least in a number of his stops, was the problem of North Korea. And properly understood, as we've discussed many times, the relationship between China and North Korea. You participated handsomely, I might say, in a briefing in Washington last week for us and spoke about some of the evidence of real material support by the Chinese to the North Koreans in terms of their threat to us. And it's stunning when you think of it in all of its detail. Talk a little bit about that, Gordon, and where you think we stand at the moment in the relationship between, first of all, the Chinese and the North Koreans, and Donald Trump's efforts to try to get the Chinese to bring the North Koreans to heel.
Well, the Chinese support the North Korean economy. They also support North Korea diplomatically. But what is extremely disturbing is that there has been this constant flow of components, equipment, and material to the North Koreans from China for the North's nuclear weapons program. Many people have talked about the missile launchers that the Chinese have supplied the North Koreans, but also it appears that the Chinese has supplied technology for North Korea's most advanced missiles, more advanced than the intercontinental ballistic missiles that the North Koreans tested twice in July. There is evidence that North Korea's solid fuel missiles look to be variants of China's JL-1 submarine-launched missile. We don't know how the North Koreans got that technology, but the least likely explanation is that they developed it on their own. Also, April 15th, we saw a very large Chinese canister being paraded through the North Korean capital in the annual Kim Il-sung celebration. That looks like China's canister for its DF-41 missile. A DF-41 has a range of at least 8,700 miles, and if fired from North Korea, it would reach all of the American homeland. We need to ask the Chinese, how come all of this Chinese-looking equipment is appearing in North Korea's inventory? The Trump administration has been putting pressure on the Chinese to stop this flow of materials and technology. It's been ramping it up in steps. I think the administration is going to have to go full bore on the Chinese because they do not seem to be taking the hint.
And when you say that it's a continuing problem, Gordon, is there reason to believe that despite President Trump's efforts and his ostensibly good relationship with Xi Jinping, the president of China, that they are nonetheless enabling this threat of the North Korean missiles and nuclear capabilities to metastasize even as we speak?
Yes, the Chinese clearly have permitted this situation. They've actually emboldened the North Koreans. And I suspect that when that high Chinese official who just wrapped up his four-day trip to Pyongyang, Song Tao, who's the head of the Communist Party's liaison department, in other words, the department that conducts relations with fraternal communist states and other parties around the world, I think that probably the Chinese told the North Koreans, look, you know, you can do what you want. You know, we've got your back. Because across the board, Beijing supports North Korea, and they wouldn't be supporting North Korea if they didn't want this situation to continue. They could stop this at almost any moment by cutting off the money, by cutting off the diplomatic support, by getting the banks out of the money laundering business, and by stopping all this flow of technology and materials for the North Koreans' WMD and missile programs. It's a very simple equation. You don't need to go to school to understand what's going on.
It's a double game, it certainly sounds like, saying one thing to Trump and behaving very differently. Let me ask you about two things that are kind of interrelated in that department, Gordon Chang. One is that the Chinese apparently, according to the Wall Street Journal, had anticipated that they would get some further bennies in that double game with Trump by promising to open up their financial sector to Western and specifically American companies. Apparently, there was no interest expressed in that by the Trump visiting team. I'd be interested in your thoughts on that. And also, there was a report about a week ago in Politico about Steve Bannon, the former presidential strategist and Svengali, I guess you might say, being, as the newspaper put it, fixated on China and intensively studying up on it and trying to be, I think, equipped to address what he considers to be the war that China is waging against us, economic warfare at least. What are your thoughts on how Trump is playing this hand and what role Steve Bannon's fixation might be playing in that handling of the hand?
Yeah, well, the Chinese certainly need more money right now because we see that foreign direct investment declined last year in dollar terms. It was down the first 7 months of this year. That's an historic turnaround from the increasing flow of Western and other cash into China. And so the Chinese are going to open up their economy because they do need money. And it's good that President Trump did not express an interest in that. Because the last thing we need is China getting funding for all of its problems from us. Bannon has been talking about China for some time, and clearly he identifies it, and correctly so, as a existential threat to the West and to the United States. He is going to make this an issue at the 2018 election and beyond, and good for him. Because the Chinese have been challenging us across the board, engaging in the most destructive tactics, and we have not confronted it with the seriousness that this challenge deserves. So it's good for Bannon for talking about this, because we do need to begin a national conversation on our relations with Beijing.
Amen. Well, your contributions to that conversation are important, to say the least, Gordon Chang, and I'm delighted that some of them we're able to relay here. Let me ask you about one other thing before we have to let you go, and that is, in the course of his travels, the president met with the president of the Philippines, Duterte. Some have called him the Trump of the East. Give us a tea leaf reading on what happened there, the nature of that relationship at the moment, and more to the point, where you think the Philippines are likely to head as potentially a very important ally at a difficult time in the Western Pacific.
Yeah, Rodrigo Duterte, the president of the Philippines, has been a very troublesome ally. He has wanted to defect to Beijing and to Moscow, as he calls it. He had very bad relations with President Obama because President Obama raised the issue of the extrajudicial killings of drug dealers and drug users. President Trump had a 40-minute meeting with him, very friendly. I think what President Trump did was he corralled Duterte, as President Trump corralled another troublesome ally, President Moon Jae-in of South Korea. This is a continuing story. You can't declare final victory. This is a struggle every day with Duterte, but at least we're on the right road. I would have liked Trump to have talked about human rights in public, but I understand why he didn't, because that would have gotten Duterte a little bit more upset at us. But nonetheless, there are so many complex issues here. I think Trump did a good job in his meeting with the Philippine counterpart.
Let's see, as they say, the proof of the pudding being in the eating, of whether it pans out at a moment when I fear that the Chinese double game is going to continue to manifest itself. Gordon Chang, I think you do too, as not only ongoing support for the threat from North Korea, but also a continuing domination of the South China Sea and perhaps the East China Sea as well. Dangerous times in which it will be important for us to have reliable allies in that part of the world. Thank you, my friend, for your time. You are always a reliable source on all of these matters, and we appreciate your visiting with us. We'll look forward to doing so with you again next week. Next up, we'll talk a little bit about some of these issues with Kevin Freeman. That and much more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. Kevin Freeman joins us from his remote location, I believe in Texas, where we often catch up with him. In fact, we do this each week, and I'm so pleased to be able to visit with men I've come to consider one of the country's foremost experts on economic warfare. This is the subject, of course, of his blog, economicwarfare.com, and of his two best-selling books, Secret Weapon and Game Plan. Check all of these out. They're fantastically valuable resources, as is Kevin himself. Welcome back, Kevin. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank.
So you've been writing a bit lately about the stage being set for the next financial attack, including three separate developments that feature prominently in the news in the past couple of days. Talk a little bit about them, Kevin, and why we should be interpreting them as ominous signs.
Well, the next financial attack is a serious problem because we've actually added to our debt. We've added to our derivative exposure. You know, everything that was the problem now 9, 10, 11 years ago is becoming a problem again, only worse. Our total debt now exceeds 105% of our gross domestic product. We have negative interest rates in certain parts of the world where people are actually paying someone to borrow money from them. We have really a disturbing, huge position from the central banks in all of the debt that's owned in the world. So the United States Central Bank now has a large percentage of our gross domestic product, which is the Federal Reserve, and other central banks have very large percentage, and they're holding all this debt. In other words, we're just printing and manufacturing money so that we can keep the debt binge going on, and that's a huge vulnerability.
It is indeed. And to the extent that it is a vulnerability, you have also been warning us for some time that there are those who are poised, if not actually actively pursuing, ways to exploit that vulnerability. Is there any further news on that front, Kevin?
We have the news that there was a leak out at The Intercept that showed that the United Arab Emirates was going to use financial weapons to try and attack Qatar. And they were going to do it to try and end the World Cup being played there. That's just proof that everyone in the world is aware of these financial weapons undermining through derivatives and credit default swaps and so forth, perhaps other than a handful of people in our own government. This is a new game that's being played. It's, you know, we talk about it. We think it's an economic marketplace. Our enemies think it's a global battle space.
And Kevin, apparently the Supreme Allied Commander Europe has been sounding a note about the possibility that we may face not just economic warfare threats from the likes of communist China and Russia, but actually the old-fashioned kinetic kind as well. Indeed, General Dennis Mercier has apparently indicated that he thinks the risk for a major interstate conflict has increased as non-Western powers, including Russia and China, have begun really changing what has been since basically the end of World War II, a U.S.-led balance of power. Do you find that credible?
Well, absolutely. The linchpin quote in the article that was in The Hill says, China is leveraging its economic power to increase defense spending as a foundation of the growing global power strategy. And the point of that is it starts with economic war. If they undermine our economy and literally steal from us to build up their economy, they then have the ability to acquire the technologies to do the defense spending that puts them in a stronger position relative to us. So it begins with economic war. If we ignore the economic war, we just worsen the situation.
It does seem to be feeding into the other dynamic as well, doesn't it? Which raises another set of questions, Kevin Freeman, and that is there's a report that came out last week about the surveillance cameras China is manufacturing that are now increasingly being used all over the United States. The U.S. Army, for example, is using them to monitor a base in Missouri, and lots of businesses and even individuals are hanging them in their homes or places of work to keep an eye on them. I'm told that the cameras have been keeping watch on the embassy in Kabul that are made in China. This is a staggering problem, and it kind of calls to mind the idea that we can rely on the Russians to protect us against cyber threats with their software, which has been now recognized to be a vulnerability, not a helpmate. Are there vulnerabilities associated with these cameras going up all over the place as well?
Absolutely. This Hikvision, they currently are being used in China to monitor their citizens, but it's insane to believe that the Chinese would not require something at some aspect to the camera, or at least know the camera so intimately that they could find a vulnerability so that they could hack in and look at everything that we're doing that has a Hikvision camera. We have to be very cautious when any supplier comes to us and offers anything to do with our security, especially if it's a foreign supplier, and especially if it's a foreign supplier like China. So that's a serious problem that we have, and it fits in. The Chinese, you know, have commenting on the unrest in American society, and that's one of the things. They're building up their military. They're stealing our jobs and secrets, and now they're placing cameras so that we can monitor our citizens with those, and then they can also.
Yeah, well, it's one thing that citizens think they're monitoring themselves. If other people are doing it, our own government, heavens forfend, let alone the Chinese, it's a totally different deal. It raises another question. Yeah, Kevin Freeman, again, you've been thinking about these things in a number of different contexts, but talk a little bit about this problem that we may find similar sorts of vulnerabilities inherent in this so-called Internet of Things, the coming rage, it seems, with everything from your refrigerator to your home security system. How serious a problem is this if, in fact, unwelcome monitors are gaining access to, or perhaps in a position to disrupt the Internet of Things?
We've talked about this for several years, and a few years ago, I issued warnings because there was the brake problem of Toyota automobiles, and all of a sudden, Toyota's had problems with their brakes. The next thing you know, they said, well, maybe it was floor mats or something like that. At the same moment, Toyota had just ascended as the world's top automaker, and China was wanting to build their domestic auto industry. And I made the comment, it's possible. I had no proof. I had no evidence whatsoever. But it's possible that a Chinese auto manufacturer could have hacked into Toyota and had a few brake problems and dethroned them as the top automaker. And it was just a theory of to point out the vulnerabilities that we have. Well, that was dismissed entirely. Oh, it's not even possible. But there was an article in the Wall Street Journal recently that said that every car that has these systems could be hacked in. And that's the fact. That's the fact is that if you have cars that are connected to the Internet, whether it's a Tesla or anything else, they have security vulnerabilities. And so the requirement was, well, we'll just require that the automobiles automatically regularly update their software so that they can patch those vulnerabilities, which is just saying they're very real vulnerabilities. You could lock a person in their car. You could use the navigation system and drive them somewhere they don't want to go. You could force acceleration. You could prevent the brakes from working. They could be used as mechanisms to kill people or destroy economies. So they're very vulnerable.
One can only imagine how much more acute that problem becomes when the cars are supposedly driverless, and you've got no possibility of any kind of driver override. It's really an incredible portfolio, and I'm so glad that you are on top of it to the extent anybody is, Kevin Freeman, and we appreciate your visiting with us each week to discuss it. We'll look forward to doing it with you next week. In the meantime, stay well. In the meantime, I hope the rest of you will join us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.